This is the Cornerstone Companion Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Vic McCracken, Assistant Professor of Theology and Ethics at Abilene Christian University. This podcast features interviews of ACU Cornerstone Spotlight speakers, students, and some outside voices. Thank you for listening in.
Dr. Paul Morris is Professor of Physics and Philosophy at Abilene Christian University, named ACU's Professor of the Year in 2003. His areas of expertise include the history and philosophy of science, science and religion, and theoretical physics. Dr. Morris, welcome to our studio today.
Thank you very much.
I want to ask you a few questions about your lecture as well as the writing requirement that you gave. You actually wrote a paper for our students this week, one that I thought was very well written and enlightening. You raise a host of really deep questions and issues, and I'm going to ask you to help our students probe those a bit more deeply. So let me ask you the first question. It has to do with the distinction that you made in your lecture today, as well as in your paper, between belief and knowledge. You talk about how we all have beliefs, but as thinking people, what we aspire to is not simply belief, but a justified true belief, which is how you define knowledge. So I can believe something to be true and not be justified in believing it. I can believe something to be true and it could be wrong. It could be a false belief. So justified true belief is what you say we should aspire to. I'm curious, you're a scientist. I'd like you to talk for us for just a moment how within your field you pursue justification for the beliefs that scientists profess. And then I'd like you to maybe extrapolate for our students from there. There are other areas of knowledge that we pursue. How would we pursue justified true belief outside of the scientific realm?
Okay. The science that we deal with obviously deals with the natural world, and I want to emphasize that's all I'm talking about here. So we gather information about the natural world. We put that into some kind of hypothesis. We try to understand why that phenomena occurs, and we form a theory or hypothesis, and from that theory, then you have consequences that are deduced. So if the consequences that are deduced turn out under experimentation to occur, these are new phenomena, then you feel pretty good about the theory. Now, obviously, the wider the range of phenomena that you can bring under the rubric of this theory, the better you feel about the theory. If something happens that you have a prediction from the theory and it doesn't occur, there are several things you can do. You can start over. You can make a correction to your theory to see if that correction could incorporate, the aberrant phenomena. And the justification then is seen if my theory explains all the phenomena I started out with, but also produces, new results that I never thought about before. Philosophers of science would argue that that's justification for belief in the theory. Now you have, obviously, philosophers and scientists who would argue that as to what level of justification you require. So if you're talking about the atomic world, electrons and things like that that you never see, some philosophers would say you're not justified in believing in electrons. Those people would be called anti-realist. Whereas people generally who work in physics, would argue, say, for something like an electron, it's not just one theory that justifies the existence of the electron, but many different kinds of theories that use the electron. Say seven or eight different theories that are sort of independent theory. They all use electrons, and they raise the question, is it not justified for me to believe in an electron? How do we account for all these theories giving us the right answer? Mm-hmm. Is it a fiction? Is the electron a fiction that somehow miraculously works in all these different areas?
So the idea would be that in science, that if you've got an idea that can be potentially falsified, and it's not falsified, it's verified not just in one experiment, but in many experiments, and then in many different areas, the information gleaned from those experiments is found to be useful in explaining other things, that all of that coheres in a way that gives justification for believing in the theory.
Okay. And you mentioned a very important term there. I mean, historically, the first term that was suggested was verification. That's the important thing. We need to verify a theory. Historically, then, in the 1950s, this idea of falsification came up, that a theory that is not falsifiable really is not a good scientific theory. Mm-hmm. But yes, the coherence, you have a sort of a combination of all three theories of truth: the correspondence theory, the coherence theory, but also the pragmatist view that, you know, quantum theory works, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you've talked about science and the way that you can sort of experimentally verify scientific claims. But how does that play out in other areas where maybe experiments aren't quite as available? For example, if we think about the idea of moral truth, would we want to make the same claim about how we pursue justification for moral claims? Think about the example of the question that you raised for us in the lecture today about whether or not dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was morally right or wrong. Most of our students said it was morally wrong in both cases. And so how would a person even begin going about justifying a claim like that?
Well, let me say something first in connection with your previous question, that a lot of students see science as hard. But actually, knowledge-wise, science is probably the easiest, next to mathematics, because we're dealing with things that are controllable. And that control sort of minimizes the parameters that, you know, can vary in a situation. So as you go through sort of the scientific hierarchy, physics, which is seen as the most difficult of the sciences, theoretically should be the easiest because it's dealing with the simplest kinds of systems. Then you move to chemistry and biology. In biology, you're dealing with a human system. But then you move into groups of human beings where now you start having questions of morality that are raised, and it seems to me that the level of difficulty just sort of exponentially explodes. So how would I go about approaching a moral question? Einstein made the comment that science is simply common sense approach to knowledge, and I think that's probably right. I mean, obviously, when we talk about the question of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we have students who differ. We have philosophers who differ as to, you know, to the results, but. This is a tough question. I mean, you gather as much information as you can. As I said, you can take specific responses that people make that are just sort of existential kind of responses to the issue. But then you look at what philosophers have said in a more general way, or theologians have said in a more general way about moral questions, what the sages of the past, the saints, have said. You look at, again, what philosophers say are possible ultimate values, and it's in science, sometimes we call science inference to the best explanation. And that's sort of what I see in, as we explore moral theory. How do we get to the best explanation? How do we understand, you know, these, what is right and wrong? And I mean, to me, it's a question that is another question that I've had a lot of difficulty with in my life. You know, how can I, seeing the same amount of information, the same principles as someone else who I think is equally honest in seeking the truth, how do I come up with a different ending or moral belief about an event? It seems to me that there are some psychological factors that enter into that.
Let me throw the skeptic's voice into this.
Skeptic so needs to be
if you
here.
If we think about the Nazis in the 1930s and the early 1940s, and we think about Americans who were maybe conscious of the things that the Nazi regime was wanting to perpetrate in the 1930s toward the Jewish people, my guess is if we compare people who were in Germany and people who were in America, and we were to talk about people who knew a lot scientifically, that there would be very little debate or disagreement looking at scientific truth such as it is and seeing the way that that might develop in terms of the creation of weapons and the like. In other words, there's not a lot of debate or difference among scientists about how to invent a nuclear bomb.
Right.
The issue is,
that's
how
right.
do you do it?
Right.
But, you know, we can look at those two communities, and we can see the way that morality kind of plays itself out in both cases, where you've got one group of people that at least has some who feel morally justified in perpetrating injustice toward the Jews, and others that are morally opposed to that. And I guess my question would be, you know, if we're wanting to say there is a moral truth out there that is the same, you know, in some way synonymous to the kinds of truths that we get in science, then wouldn't we see a similar, you know, correspondence to the way we see the world? In other words, why should we not say, you know, maybe everything is just kind of relative? If we look at the diversity of moral practices, we look at, you know, cultural pluralism, why should we believe that whenever we speak about moral truths, that we're speaking about truth or knowledge? Why, you know, can you help us with that a little bit?
I mean, you seem to be asking me two questions. Separate the. Let me talk about the scientist in the United States and in Germany. So, in the United States, this is a number that I've seen, that the people who worked on the Manhattan Project, scientists, mathematicians who worked on the Manhattan Project, 75% of those were opposed to the use of the bomb. I mean, they saw the bomb and creating the bomb as more of a deterrent to Hitler Germany than, you know, to the Japanese, you know, the Japanese people. They thought when Hitler surrendered that, you know, there was no more need for, you know, even having the bomb as a deterrent. And I, from what I've read, and I've read quite a bit, you know, in Germany, there is an impressive number of scientists who, when Hitler comes to power, simply, I mean, some of them were Jewish and had to get out, but there were, you know, a significant number of scientists, Gentiles who, you know, out of solidarity for their Jewish colleagues, just quit university positions. Some of them went to other countries. Some of them were old enough, you know, just to retire in Germany. Now, one of the most famous people who didn't was Werner Heisenberg, who was apparently in charge of the German project. And there are various, you know, you could do a psychological analysis of Heisenberg to see, was he doing it for, you know, more selfish reasons? Did he, you know, it's fairly clear that he, after the war, said, you know, it was just unjustifiable what the Germans did to the Jewish people. So that's one response to the science. Now, what about the relativity of value? First of all, my first response would be, truth is not a democratic, it's not determined democratically. And so even, you know, even if you look at cultures that differ, does not mean that moral truths should differ. Another way of saying that is that, I think David Hume said, you can't get an it, you can't get an ought from an is. So you can't look at cultures and the way they are and say this is the way a culture ought to be. Now I'm not an anthropologist, but I do have some anthropologist friends who say to me that if you look at a culture closely, even those cultures that do, you know, what we might see as very immoral, like kill the elderly or kill children. I mean, most of those seem to do it for a reason that has to do with quality of life. I mean, once a person gets old enough, they've had their chance, and it's time for someone else, you know, to come along. So they may, you know, they may do something to end the life of that person. So the question, you know, the traditional question that philosophers ask is it morally okay to torture a child just for the heck of it, just for the fun of it? And I don't think you see that kind, you don't think you see that kind of reaction in a culture. So maybe even though these cultures on first glance look to be very diverse and have no moral values in common, maybe it, in most cultures, there is this value of life, even though it may differ from, you know, what we perceive as the value of life. They still see that as a very important value.
So in short, what you're saying is that the relativist argument depends on this idea that there's this vast cultural diversity that contradicts the idea that there's a single moral truth. Sure. What I hear you saying is that beneath the surface diversity, there are still some basic values that might present themselves in different ways in different cultures, but there's still a basic foundation that they share in common.
And all you need is one moral value to destroy relativism.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Of course, this is an area where I do a lot of work in, since I study ethics as a discipline. So it's one of those areas that we spend lots of time talking about, because not all ethicists agree that we can talk about something as like moral truth and treat it similarly to the way we talk about propositional truth. There are some that will say that, well, we treat morality that way, like our moral claims correspond to something, but there's nothing essentially that our claims correspond to. So it's kind of a useful fiction that we create for ourselves. Let me ask you one more question. So one of the other areas that you touched on in your lecture today had to do with pursuit of theological truth, pursuit of knowledge of God. And in particular, you talked about the different sources that Christians might consult as they seek truth about God. You mentioned pursuit of God through sacred text, for example. And I was thinking, as you were talking about maybe the counter-argument from a person outside of the Christian community that might say, well, you know, that's all good that you say that we should consult the Bible to pursue knowledge about God, but doesn't that simply raise the question, why should I trust that the Bible and the claims that it makes about God are true? How would you respond to that concern?
Well, I was trying to be very careful in the way I stated that. I think I said one of the ways that we might approach, you know, knowledge of God is through a sacred text. For me, in both the areas of morality and religion, there is both existential concerns and intellectual concerns. So in religion, does God exist? And if so, what kind of God is it that exists? So, you know, one of the places that I first look at is the creation. And this may relate to the Hawking question. When I look at creation, and I don't want to use the Paley argument from design, which is sort of an argument of sort of a local argument where he emphasizes the eyes and parts of creation. But as far as the holistic universe, the creation, and what cosmology tells us about the creation is it's a pretty amazing thing that it seems very, very difficult to explain it by just being a coincidence, as someone like Bertrand Russell would have us believe. So that there are certain constants in the universe that you could adjust very, very minutely, and it would destroy the possibility of life anywhere in the universe. And it's a very, very small change. So the argument is called the fine-tuning, that if, let's say, you're given a control board that has 30 dials on it, and you can dial up a universe with your speed of light and your strength of gravity and the strength of the force between electrons and protons. You can control those. That it would be an extraordinarily low improbability for you to dial up a universe where a human being could exist. What would happen, let's say, if gravity is much stronger, stars would collapse more quickly and they would not live long enough for life to develop, you know, in the universe. If gravity is weaker, then maybe stars would not even, you know, condense to the, to the state where nuclear processes could take over and you could actually generate enough energy to support life. So, I mean, and the atheists can come back and respond in various ways that, well, maybe there are an infinite number of universes that just have all these possible combinations, and therefore one of the universes is likely to have, you know, the possibility of life. The explanation I accept is, you know, there is one universe that the Creator knew what those settings would be and dialed up the universe that we live in. You know, which are you gonna? I don't know that one of those arguments is stronger than the other. Maybe because my background is a Christian background, that psychologically I'm predisposed to believe, you know, that. But then I look, you know, existentially, I look at a God who cared enough to send his own son, you know, for my sake. And that's a pretty important factor, you know, that It's the only it's the only world religion that has that kind of personal concern of the deity. Maybe that's just hope. Maybe that's just wish fulfillment, as some would say.
Sounds like you're saying is that the claims we make about God, that it's very difficult for us to ever make those claims of knowledge.
It's always, I think it's always possible for someone to come back and reject my claims. But it seems to me that in science, it's always possible for an anti-realist to come back and reject my claims about the existence of electrons. In that case, it seems that the anti-realist has a whole lot more stricter concern for justification than most scientists do. And so I don't know how that would play. I don't know how that would play out, in the theological sense. But yeah, I think maybe that's where faith comes in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mystery for me here.
Yeah, well, you have me thinking that, because, getting back to what you said about science and truth, you talked about the idea that a scientific claim coheres with the things that we see in other areas of science. So, like, the existence of electrons makes sense of other areas. It allows us to progress.
Right.
And maybe something similar could be said about claims about God, is that there are certain areas of human life that there's a certain sense that's made of them in ways that the non-existence of God would simply not make sense of. I mean, that's kind of the Kantian argument from morality, the idea that there is a moral claim to be made for the existence of God, that that morality itself, the idea that moral truth can actually exist, that it's more difficult to make that claim absent the existence of God. I understand that the claims that we make about morality, we probably can't make with the same level of certitude, or certainly claims about God can't be made with the same level of certitude as we make about claims about gravity or the hard sciences. What I hear you saying is that we should be careful not to dispense with claims about God altogether.
I would be very uncomfortable doing that. I mean, again, you mentioned the coherence idea just a minute ago. I'm a strong believer in coherence of everything. For me, everything in my life has to fit together. My science, my politics, my religion. I can't be schizophrenic about any of those important things in my life start to break off. It's a big problem for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I have been through periods of agnosticism. I don't think I was ever at a period of atheism, but what brought me back was a sense of hope that had to be. I mean, if I was to continue as a human being, I had to have that hope, and that's the only place I saw hope was in my Christian, my Christian faith.
Well, there is so much more we could talk about, but we've already gone a long time today, and perhaps the right place to leave our students this week is in the murkiness of this pursuit of justified true belief. And so, Dr. Morris, I want to thank you for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.